Sometime before daylight, something took one of the baits that were behind him. He heard the stick break and the line begin to rush out over the gunwale of the skiff. In the darkness, he loosened his sheath knife, and taking all the strain of the fish on his left shoulder, he leaned back and cut the line against the wood of the gunwale. Then he cut the other line closest to him, and in the dark, made the loose ends of the reserve coils fast. He worked skillfully with one hand and put his foot on the coils to hold them as he drew his knots tight. Now he had 6 reserve coils of line. There were 2 from each bait he had severed, and the 2 from the bait the fish had taken, and they were all connected. After it is light, he thought, I will work back to the 40-fathom bait and cut it away too and link up the reserve coils. I will have lost 200 fathoms of good Catalan cardel, and the hooks and the leaders. That can be replaced. But who replaces this fish if I hook some fish and it cuts him off? I don't know what that fish was that took the bait just now. It could have been a marlin or a broadbill or a shark. I never felt him. I had to get rid of him too fast. Aloud, he said, I wish I had the boy. But you haven't got the boy, he thought. You have only yourself, and you had better work back to the last line now, in the dark or not in the dark, and cut it away and hook up the 2 reserve coils. So he did it. It was difficult in the dark, and once the fish made a surge that pulled him down in his face and made a cut below his eye. The blood ran down his cheek a little way, but it coagulated and dried before it reached his chin, and he worked his way back to the bow and rested against the wood. He adjusted the sack and carefully worked the line so that it came across a new part of his shoulders, and holding it anchored with his shoulders, he carefully felt the pull of the fish, and then felt with his hand the progress of the skiff through the water. I wonder what he made that lurch for, he thought. The wire must have slipped on the great hill of his back. Certainly his back cannot feel as badly as mine does, but he cannot pull this skiff forever, no matter how great he is. Now everything is cleared away that might make trouble, and I have a big reserve of line, all that a man can ask. Fish, he said softly aloud, I'll stay with you until I am dead. He'll stay with me too, I suppose, the old man thought, and he waited for it to be light. It was cold now in the time before daylight, and he pushed against the wood to be warm. I can do it as long as he can, he thought. And in the first light the line extended out and down into the water. The boat moved steadily, and when the first edge of the sun rose, it was on the old man's right shoulder. He's headed north, the old man said. The current will have set us far to the eastward, he thought. I wish he would turn with the current. That would show that he is tiring. When the sun had risen further, the old man realized that the fish was not tiring. There was only one favorable sign. The slant of the line showed he was swimming at a lesser depth. That did not necessarily mean that he would jump, but he might. God let him jump, the old man said. I have enough line to handle him. Maybe if I can increase the tension just a little, it will hurt him and he will jump, he thought. Now that it is daylight, let him jump so that he'll fill the sacks along his backbone with air, and then he cannot go deep to die. He tried to increase the tension, but the line had been taut up to the very edge of the breaking point since he had hooked the fish, and he felt the harshness as he leaned back to pull, and knew he could put no more strain on it. I must not jerk it ever, he thought. Each jerk widens the cut the hook makes, and then when he does jump he might throw it. Anyway, I feel better with the sun, and for once I do not have to look into it. There was yellow weed on the line, but the old man knew that only made an added drag, and he was pleased. It was the gulf weed that made so much phosphorescence in the night. Fish, he said, I love you and respect you very much, but I will kill you dead before this day ends. Let us hope so, he thought. A small bird came aboard the skiff from the north. He was a warbler and flying very low over the water. The old man could see that he was very tired. The bird made the stern of the boat and rested there. Then he flew around the old man's head and rested on the line where he was more comfortable. How old are you? The old man asked the bird. Is this your first trip? The bird looked at him when he spoke. He was too tired even to examine the line, and he teetered on it as his delicate feet gripped it fast. "It's steady," the old man told him. "It's too steady. You shouldn't be that tired after a windless night. What are birds coming to?" "The hawks," he thought, "that come out to sea to meet them." But he said nothing of this to the bird, who could not understand him anyway, and who would learn about the hawks soon enough. "Take a good rest, small bird," he said. "Then go in and take your chance like any man or bird or fish." It encouraged him to talk because his back had stiffened in the night and it hurt truly now. "Stay at my house if you like, bird," he said. "I'm sorry I cannot hoist a sail and take you in with the small breeze that is rising, but I am with a friend." Just then the fish gave a sudden lurch that pulled the old man down onto the bow and would have pulled him overboard if he had not braced himself and given some line. The bird had flown up when the line jerked, and the old man had not even seen him go. He felt the line carefully with his right hand and noticed his hand was bleeding. "Something hurt him then," he said aloud, and pulled back on the line to see if he could turn the fish. But when he was touching the breaking point, he held steady and settled back against the strain of the line. "You're feeling it now, fish," he said, "and so, God knows, am I." He looked around for the bird now, because he would have liked him for company. The bird was gone. "You did not stay long," the old man thought. "But it is rougher where you are going until you make the shore. How did I let the fish cut me with that one quick pull he made? I must be getting very stupid. Or perhaps I was looking at the small bird and thinking of him. Now I will pay attention to my work, and then I must eat the tuna so that I will not have a failure of strength. I wish the boy were here and that I had some salt," he said aloud. Shifting the weight of the line to his left shoulder and kneeling carefully, he washed his hand in the ocean and held it there, submerged, for more than a minute, watching the blood trail away and the steady movement of the water against his hand as the boat moved. "He has slowed much," he said. The old man would have liked to keep his hand in the salt water longer, but he was afraid of another sudden lurch by the fish, and he stood up and braced himself and held his hand up against the sun. It was only a line burn that had cut his flesh, but it was in the working part of his hand. He knew he would need his hands before this was over, and he did not like to be cut before it started. "Now," he said when his hand had dried, "I must eat the small tuna. I can reach him with a gaff and eat him up here in comfort." He knelt down and found the tuna under the stern with the gaff and drew it toward him, keeping it clear of the coiled lines. Holding the line with his left shoulder again and bracing on his left hand and arm, he took the tuna off the gaff hook and put the gaff back in its place. He put one knee on the fish and cut strips of dark red meat longitudinally from the back of the head to the tail. They were wedge-shaped strips, and he cut them from next to the backbone down to the edge of the belly. When he had cut 6 strips, he spread them out on the wood of the bow, wiped his knife on his trousers, and lifted the carcass of the bonito by the tail and dropped it overboard. "I don't think I can eat an entire one," he said, and drew his knife across one of the strips. He could feel the steady, hard pull of the line, and his left hand was cramped. It drew up tight on the heavy cord, and he looked at it in disgust. "What kind of a hand is that?" he said. "Cramp, then, if you want. Make yourself into a claw. It will do you no good." "Come on," he thought, and looked down into the dark water at the slant of the line. "Eat it now, and it will strengthen the hand. It is not the hand's fault, and you have been many hours with a fish. But you can stay with him forever. Eat the bonita now." He picked up a piece and put it in his mouth and chewed it slowly. It was not unpleasant. "Chew it well," he thought, "and get all the juices. It would not be bad to eat with a little lime or with lemon or with salt." "How do you feel, hand?" he asked the cramped hand that was almost as stiff as rigor mortis. "I'll eat some more for you." He ate the other part of the piece that he had cut in two. He chewed it carefully and then spat out the skin. "How does it go, hand? Or is it too early to know?" He took another full piece and chewed it. It is a strong, full-blooded fish, he thought. I was lucky to get him instead of a dolphin. Dolphin is too sweet. This is hardly sweet at all, and all the strength is still in it. There is no sense in being anything but practical, though, he thought. I wish I had some salt, and I do not know whether the sun will rot or dry what is left, so I had better eat it all, though I am not hungry. The fish is calm and steady. I will eat it all, and then I will be ready. Be patient, hand, he said. I do this for you. I wish I could feed the fish, he thought. He is my brother, but I must kill him and keep strong to do it. Slowly and conscientiously, he ate all of the wedge-shaped strips of fish. He straightened up, wiping his hand on his trousers. Now, he said, you can let the cord go, hand, and I will handle him with the right arm alone until you stop that nonsense. He put his left foot on the heavy line that the left hand had held, and lay back against the pole, against his back. God help me to have the cramp go, he said, because I do not know what the fish is going to do. But he seems calm, he thought, and following his plan. But what is his plan, he thought? And what is mine? Mine I must improvise to his because of his great size. If he will jump, I can kill him. But he stays down forever. Then I will stay down with him forever. He rubbed his cramped hand against his trousers and tried to gentle the fingers, but it would not open. Maybe it will open with the sun, he thought. Maybe it will open when the strong raw tuna is digested. If I have to have it, I will open it, cost whatever it costs, but I do not want to open it now by force. Let it open by itself and come back of its own accord. After all, I abused it much in the night when it was necessary to free and untie the various lines. He looked across the sea and knew how alone he was now. But he could see the prisms in the dark, deep water, and the line stretching ahead and the strange undulation of the calm. The clouds were building up now for the trade wind, and he looked ahead and saw a flight of wild ducks etching themselves against the sky over the water, then blurring, then etching again, and he knew no man was ever alone on the sea. He thought of how some men feared being out of sight of land in a small boat, and knew they were right in the months of sudden bad weather, but now they were in hurricane months, and when there are no hurricanes, the weather of hurricane months is the best of all the year. If there is a hurricane, you always see the signs of it in the sky for days ahead if you are at sea. They do not see it ashore because they do not know what to look for, he thought. The land must make a difference, too, in the shape of the clouds. But we have no hurricane coming now. He looked at the sky and saw the white cumulus built like friendly piles of ice cream, and high above them were the thin feathers of the cirrus against the high September sky. Light brisa, he said. Better weather for me than for you, fish. His left hand was still cramped, but he was unknotting it slowly. I hate a cramp, he thought. It is a treachery of one's own body. It is humiliating before others to have a diarrhea from ptomaine poisoning or to vomit from it. But a cramp, he thought of it as a calambre, humiliates oneself, especially when one is alone. If the boy were here, he would rub it for me and loosen it down from the forearm, he thought. But it will loosen up. Then with his right hand he felt the difference in the pull of the line before he saw the slant change in the water. Then, as he leaned against the line and slapped his left hand hard and fast against his thigh, he saw the line slanting slowly upward. He's coming up, he said. Come on, hand, please come on. The line rose slowly and steadily, and then the surface of the ocean bulged ahead of the boat, and the fish came out. He came out unendingly, and the water poured from his sides. He was bright in the sun, and his head and back were dark purple, and in the sun the stripes on his sides showed wide and a light lavender. His sword was as long as a baseball bat, and tapered like a rapier, and he rose his full length from the water, and then he re-entered it smoothly, like a diver. and the old man saw the great scythe blade of his tail go under, and the line commenced to race out. "He is 2 feet longer than the skiff," the old man said. The line was going out fast but steadily, and the fish was not panicked. The old man was trying with both hands to keep the line just inside of breaking strength. He knew that if he could not slow the fish with a steady pressure, the fish could take all the line and break it. "He is a great fish, and I must convince him," he thought. "I must never let him learn his strength nor what he could do if he made his run. If I were him, I would put in everything now and go until something broke. But thank God they are not as intelligent as we who kill them, although they are more noble and more able." The old man had seen many great fish. He had seen many that weighed more than 1,000 pounds, and he had caught 2 of that size in his life, but never alone. Now, alone, and out of sight of land, he was fast to the biggest fish that he had ever seen, and bigger than he had ever heard of, and his left hand was still as tight as the gripped claws of an eagle. "It will uncramp, though," he thought. "Surely it will uncramp to help my right hand. There are 3 things that are brothers, the fish and my 2 hands. It must uncramp. It is unworthy of it to be cramped." The fish had slowed again and was going at his usual pace. "I wonder why he jumped," the old man thought. "He jumped almost as though to show me how big he was. I know now, anyway," he thought. "I wish I could show him what sort of a man I am. But then he would see the cramped hand. Let him think I am more man than I am, and I will be so. I wish I was the fish," he thought, "with everything he has against only my will and my intelligence." He settled comfortably against the wood and took his suffering as it came, and the fish swam steadily, and the boat moved slowly through the dark water. There was a small sea rising with the wind coming up from the east, and at noon the old man's left hand was uncramped. "Bad news for you, fish," he said, and shifted the line over the sacks that covered his shoulders. He was comfortable but suffering, although he did not admit the suffering at all. "I'm not religious," he said, "but I will say 10 Our Fathers and 10 Hail Marys that I should catch this fish. And I promise to make a pilgrimage to the Virgin of Cobre if I catch him. That is a promise." He commenced to say his prayers mechanically. Sometimes he would be so tired that he could not remember the prayer, and then he would say them fast so that they would come automatically. "Hail Marys are easier to say than Our Fathers," he thought. "Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou among women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death. Amen." Then he added, "Blessed Virgin, pray for the death of this fish, wonderful though he is." With his prayers said, and feeling much better, but suffering exactly as much, and perhaps a little more, he leaned against the wood of the bow and began mechanically to work the fingers of his left hand. The sun was hot now, although the breeze was rising gently. "I had better rebait that little line out over the stern," he said. "If the fish decides to stay another night, I will need to eat again, and the water is low on the bottle. I don't think I can get anything but a dolphin here. But if I eat him fresh enough, he won't be bad. I wish a flying fish would come on board tonight. But I have no light to attract them. A flying fish is excellent to eat raw, and I would not have to cut him up. I must save all my strength now. Christ, I did not know he was so big. I'll kill him, though," he said, "in all his greatness and his glory. Although it is unjust," he thought. "But I will show him what a man can do and what a man endures." "I told the boy I was a strange old man," he said. "Now is when I must prove it." The 1,000 times that he had proved it meant nothing. Now he was proving it again. Each time was a new time, and he never thought about the past when he was doing it. "I wish he'd sleep and I could sleep and dream about the lions," he thought. "Why are the lions the main thing that is left?" "Don't think, old man," he said to himself. "Rest gently now against the wood and think of nothing. He is working. Work as little as you can." It was getting into the afternoon and the boat still moved slowly and steadily. But there was an added drag now from the easterly breeze, and the old man rowed gently with the small sea, and the hurt of the cord across his back came to him easily and smoothly. Once in the afternoon the line started to rise again, but the fish only continued to swim at a slightly higher level. The sun was on the old man's left arm and shoulder, and on his back. So he knew the fish had turned east of north. Now that he had seen him once, he could picture the fish swimming in the water with his purple pectoral fins set wide as wings and the great erect tail slicing through the dark. I wonder how much he sees at that depth, the old man thought. His eye is huge, and a horse with much less eye can see in the dark. Once I could see quite well in the dark, not in the absolute dark, but almost as a cat sees. The sun and his steady movement of his fingers had uncramped his left hand now completely, and he began to shift more of the strain to it, and he shrugged the muscles of his back to shift the hurt of the cord a little. "If you're not tired, fish," he said aloud, "you must be very strange." He felt tired now, and he knew the night would come soon, and he tried to think of other things. He thought of the big leagues. To him they were the Gran Ligas. And he knew that the Yankees of New York were playing the Tigres of Detroit. "This is the second day now that I do not know the result of the Juegos," he thought. "But I must have confidence, and I must be worthy of the great DiMaggio who does all things perfectly, even with the pain of the bone spur in his heel." "What is a bone spur?" he asked himself. "Un espuela de hueso. We do not have them. Can it be as painful as the spur of a fighting cock in one's heel? I do not think I could endure that. Or the loss of the eye, and of both eyes, and continue to fight as the fighting cocks do. Man is not much beside the great birds and beasts. Still, I would rather be that beast down there in the darkness of the sea." "Unless the sharks come," he said aloud. "If sharks come, God pity him. And me. Do you believe the great DiMaggio would stay with the fish as long as I will stay with this one?" he thought. "I'm sure he would. And more, since he is young and strong. Also his father was a fisherman. But would the bone spur hurt him too much?" "I do not know," he said aloud. "I never had a bone spur." As the sun set, he remembered to give himself more confidence. The time in the tavern at Casablanca, when he had played the hand game with the great Negro from Cienfuegos, who was the strongest man on the docks. They had gone one day and one night with their elbows on a chalk line on the table, and their forearms straight up and their hands gripped tight. Each one was trying to force the other's hand down onto the table. There was much bedding, and people went in and out of the room under the kerosene lights, and he had looked at the arm and hand of the Negro, and at the Negro's face. They changed the referees every 4 hours after the first eight so that the referees could sleep. Blood came out from under the fingernails of both his and the Negro's hands, and they looked each other in the eye and at their hands and forearms, and the bettors went in and out of the room and sat on high chairs against the wall and watched. The walls were painted bright blue and were of wood, and the lamps threw their shadows against them. The Negro's shadow was huge, and it moved on the wall as the breeze moved the lamps. The odds would change back and forth all night, and they fed the Negro rum and lighted cigarettes for him. Then the Negro, after the rum, would try for a tremendous effort, and once he had the old man, who was not an old man then, but was Santiago el Campeón, nearly 3 inches off balance. But the old man had raised his hand up to a dead even again. He was sure then that he had the Negro, who was a fine man and a great athlete, beaten. And at daylight, when the bettors were asking that it be called a draw, and the referee was shaking his head, he had unleashed his effort and forced the hand of the Negro down and down until it rested on the wood. The match had started on a Sunday morning, and it ended on a Monday morning. Many of the bettors had asked for a draw because they had to go to work on the docks loading sacks of sugar, or at the Havana Coal Company. Otherwise, everyone would have wanted it to go to a finish. But he had finished it anyway, and before anyone had to go to work. For a long time after that, everyone had called him the champion, and there had been a return match in the spring. But not much money was bet, and he had won it quite easily, since he had broken the confidence of the Negro from Cienfuegos in the first match. After that, he had a few matches, and then no more. He decided that he could beat anyone if he wanted to badly enough, and he decided that it was bad for his right hand for fishing. He had tried a few practice matches with his left hand, but his left hand had always been a traitor and would not do what he called on it to do, and he did not trust it. The sun will bake it out well now, he thought. It should not cramp on me again unless it gets too cold in the night. I wonder what this night will bring. An airplane passed overhead on its course to Miami, and he watched its shadow scaring up schools of flying fish. With so much flying fish, there should be dolphin, he said, and he leaned back on the line to see if it was possible to gain any on his fish. But he could not, and it stayed at the hardness and water drop shivering that preceded breaking. The boat moved ahead slowly, and he watched the airplane until he could no longer see it. It must be very strange in an airplane, he thought. I wonder what the sea looks like from that height. They should be able to see fish well if they do not fly too high. I would like to fly very slowly at 200 fathoms high and see the fish from above. In the turtle boats I was in the crosstrees of the masthead, and even at that height I saw much. The dolphin looked greener from there, and you can see their stripes and their purple spots, and you can see all of the school as they swim. Why is it that all fast-moving fish of the dark current have purple backs and usually purple stripes or spots? The dolphin looks green, of course, because he is really golden, but when he comes to feed, truly hungry, purple stripes show on his sides as on a marlin. Can it be anger? Or the greater speed he makes that brings them out? Just before it was dark, as they passed a great island of sargasso weed that heaved and swung in the light sea as though the ocean were making love with something under a yellow blanket, his small line was taken by a dolphin. He saw it first when it jumped in the air, true gold in the last of the sun and bending and flapping wildly in the air. It jumped again and again in the acrobatics of its fear, and he worked his way back to the stern and crouching and holding the big line with his right hand and arm. He pulled the dolphin in with his left hand, stepping on the gained line each time with his bare left foot. When the fish was at the stern, plunging and cutting from side to side in desperation, the old man leaned over the stern and lifted the burnished gold fish with its purple spots over the stern. Its jaws were working convulsively in quick bites against the hook, and it pounded the bottom of the skiff with its long, flat body, its tail and its head, until he clubbed it across the shining golden head until it shivered and was still. The old man unhooked the fish, rebaited the line with another sardine, and tossed it over. Then he worked his way slowly back to the bow. He washed his left hand and wiped it on his trousers. Then he shifted the heavy line from his right hand to his left and washed his right hand in the sea while he watched the sun go into the ocean and the slant of the big cord. He hasn't changed at all, he said. But watching the movement of the water against his hand, he noted that it was perceptibly slower. I'll lash the two oars together against the stern, and that will slow him in the night. He's good for the night, and so am I. It would be better to gut the dolphin a little later to save the blood and the meat, he thought. I can do that a little later, and lash the oars to make a drag at the same time. I'd better keep the fish quiet now and not disturb him too much at sunset. The setting of the sun is a difficult time for all fish. He let his hand dry in the air, then grasped the line with it and eased himself as much as he could, and allowed himself to be pulled forward against the wood, so that the boat took the strain as much or more than he did. I'm learning how to do it, he thought. This part of it, anyway. Then, too, remember he hasn't eaten since he took the bait, and he is huge and needs much food. I have eaten the whole bonito. Tomorrow I will eat the dolphin. He called it dorado. Perhaps I should eat some of it when I clean it. It will be harder to eat than the bonito. But then, nothing is easy. How do you feel, fish? He asked aloud. I feel good and my left hand is better and I have food for a night and a day. Pull the boat, fish. He did not truly feel good because the pain from the cord across his back had almost passed pain and gone into a dullness that he mistrusted. But I have had worse things than that, he thought. My hand is only cut a little, and the cramp is gone from the other. My legs are all right. Also now I have gained on him in the question of sustenance. It was dark now, as it becomes dark quickly after the sun sets in September. He lay against the worn wood of the bow and rested all that he could. The first stars were out. He did not know the name of Rigel, but he saw it, and knew soon they would all be out, and he would have all his distant friends. "The fish is my friend, too," he said aloud. "I have never seen or heard of such a fish, but I must kill him. I'm glad we do not have to try to kill the stars." Imagine if each day a man must try to kill the moon, he thought. The moon runs away. But imagine if a man each day should have to try to kill the sun. We were born lucky, he thought. Then he was sorry for the great fish that had nothing to eat, and his determination to kill him never relaxed in his sorrow for him. How many people will he feed, he thought. But are they worthy to eat him? No, of course not. There is no one worthy of eating him from the manner of his behavior and his great dignity. I do not understand these things, he thought, but it is good that we do not have to try to kill the sun or the moon or the stars. It is enough to live on the sea and kill our true brothers. Now, he thought, I must think about the drag. It has its perils and its merits. I may lose so much line that I will lose him. If he makes his effort and the drag made by the oars is in place and the boat loses all her lightness. Her lightness prolongs both our suffering, but it is my safety, since he has great speed that he has never yet employed. No matter what passes, I must gut the dolphin so he does not spoil and eat some of him to be strong. Now I will rest an hour more and feel that he is solid and steady before I move back to the stern to do the work and make the decision. In the meantime, I can see how he acts and if he shows any changes. The oars are a good trick, but it has reached the time to play for safety. He is much fish still. And I saw that hook was in the corner of his mouth, and he kept his mouth tight shut. The punishment of the hook is nothing. The punishment of hunger, and that he is against something that he does not comprehend, is everything. Rest now, old man, and let him work until your next duty comes. He rested for what he believed to be 2 hours. The moon did not rise now until late, and he had no way of judging the time. Nor was he really resting, except comparatively. He was still bearing the pull of the fish across his shoulders, but he placed his left hand on the gunwale of the bow and confided more and more of the resistance to the fish to the skiff itself. How simple it would be if I could make the line fast, he thought. But with one small lurch he could break it. I must cushion the pull of the line with my body, and at all times be ready to give line with both hands. "But you have not slept yet, old man," he said aloud. "It is half a day and a night, and now another day, and you have not slept. You must devise a way so that you sleep a little if he is quiet and steady. If you do not sleep, you might become unclear in the head." "I'm clear enough in the head," he thought. "Too clear. I am as clear as the stars that are my brothers. Still I must sleep. They sleep, and the moon and the sun sleep, and even the ocean sleeps sometimes on certain days when there is no current and a flat calm. But remember to sleep," he thought. "Make yourself do it, and devise some simple and sure way about the lines. Now go back and prepare the dolphin. It is too dangerous to rig the oars as a drag if you must sleep." "I could go without sleeping," he told himself, "but it would be too dangerous." He started to work his way back to the stern on his hands and knees, being careful not to jerk against the fish. "He may be half asleep himself," he thought, "but I do not want him to rest. He must pull until he dies." Back in the stern, he turned so that his left hand held the strain of the line across his shoulders, and drew his knife from its sheath with his right hand. The stars were bright now, and he saw the dolphin clearly, and he pushed the blade of his knife into his head and drew him out from under the stern. He put one of his feet on the fish and slid him quickly from the vent up to the tip of his lower jaw. Then he put his knife down and gutted him with his right hand, scooping him clean and spilling the gills clear. He felt the maw heavy and slippery in his hands, and he slid it open. There were two flying fish inside. They were fresh and hard, and he laid them side by side and dropped the guts and the gills over the stern. They sank, leaving a trail of phosphorescence in the water. The dolphin was cold, and a leprous gray-white now in the starlight, and the old man skinned one side of him while he held his foot on the fish's head. Then he turned him over and skinned the other side and cut each side off from the head down to the tail. He slid the carcass overboard and looked to see if there was any swirl in the water, but there was only the light of its slow descent. He turned then and placed the two flying fish inside the two fillets of fish, and, putting his knife back in its sheath, he worked his way slowly back to the bow. His back was bent with the weight of the line across it, and he carried the fish in his right hand. Back in the bow, he laid the two fillets of fish out on the wood with the flying fish beside them. After that, he settled the line across his shoulders in a new place and held it again with his left hand resting on the gunwale. Then he leaned over the side and washed the flying fish in the water, noting the speed of the water against his hand. His hand was phosphorescent from skinning the fish, and he watched the flow of the water against it. The flow was less strong, and as he rubbed the side of his hand against the planking of the skiff, particles of phosphorus floated off and drifted slowly astern. "He is tiring, or he is resting," the old man said. "Now let me get through the eating of this dolphin and get some rest and a little sleep." Under the stars and with the night colder all the time, he ate half of one of the dolphin fillets and one of the flying fish, gutted and with its head off. "What an excellent fish dolphin is to eat cooked," he said. "And what a miserable fish raw. I will never go in a boat again without salt or limes. If I had brains, I would have splashed water on the bow all day, and drying it would have made salt," he thought. "But then I did not hook the dolphin until almost sunset. Still, it was lack of preparation. But I have chewed it all well, and I am not nauseated." The sky was clouding over to the east, and one after another the stars he knew were gone. It looked now as though he were moving into a great canyon of clouds and the wind had dropped. "There will be bad weather in 3 or 4 days," he said. "But not tonight and not tomorrow. Rig now to get some sleep, old man, while the fish is calm and steady." He held the line tight in his right hand and then pushed his thigh against his right hand as he leaned all his weight against the wood of the bow. Then he passed the line a little lower on his shoulders and braced his left hand on it. "My right hand can hold it as long as it is braced," he thought. "If it relaxes in sleep, my left hand will wake me as the line goes out. It is hard on the right hand, but he is used to punishment. Even if I sleep 20 minutes or a half an hour, it is good." He lay forward, cramping himself against the line with all of his body, putting all his weight onto his right hand, and he was asleep. He did not dream of the lions, but instead of a vast school of porpoises that stretched for 8 or 10 miles, and it was in the time of their mating, and they would leap high into the air and return into the same hole they had made in the water when they leaped. Then he dreamed that he was in the village on his bed, and there was a norther, and he was very cold, and his right arm was asleep because his head had rested on it instead of a pillow. After that he began to dream of the long yellow beach, and he saw the first of the lions come down onto it in the early dark, and then the other lions came, and he rested his chin on the wood of the bows where the ship lay anchored with the evening offshore breeze, and he waited to see if there would be more lions, and he was happy. The moon had been up for a long time, but he slept on, and the fish pulled on steadily, and the boat moved into the tunnel of clouds. He woke with the jerk of his right fist coming up against his face and the line burning out through his right hand. He had no feeling in his left hand, but he braked all he could with his right, and the line rushed out. Finally, his left hand found the line, and he leaned back against the line, and now it burned his back and his left hand, and his left hand was taking all the strain and cutting badly. He looked back at the coils of line, and they were feeding smoothly. Just then, the fish jumped, making a great bursting of the ocean and then a heavy fall. Then he jumped again and again, and the boat was going fast, although the line was still racing out, and the old man was raising the strain to a breaking point, and raising it to breaking point again and again. He had been pulled down tight onto the bow, and his face was in the cut slice of dolphin, and he could not move. "This is what we waited for," he thought. "So now let us take it." "Make him pay for the line," he thought. "Make him pay for it." He could not see the fish's jumps, but only heard the breaking of the ocean and the heavy splash as he fell. The speed of the line was cutting his hands badly. But he had always known this would happen, and he tried to keep the cutting across the calloused parts and not let the line slip into the palm nor cut the fingers. If the boy was here, he would wet the coils of line, he thought. Yes, if the boy were here. If the boy were here. The line went out and out and out, but it was slowing now, and he was making the fish earn each inch of it. Now he got his head up from the wood and out of the slice of fish that his cheek had crushed. Then he was on his knees, and then he rose slowly to his feet. He was seeding the line, but more slowly all the time. He worked back to where he could feel with his foot the coils of line that he could not see. There was plenty of line still, and now the fish had to pull the friction of all that new line through the water. Yes, he thought, and now he has jumped more than a dozen times and filled the sacks along his back with air, and he cannot go down deep to die where I cannot bring him up. He will start circling soon, and then I must work on him. I wonder what started him so suddenly. Could it have been hunger that made him desperate? Or was he frightened by something in the night? Maybe he suddenly felt fear. But he was such a strong, calm fish, and he seemed so fearless and so confident. It is strange. "You better be fearless and confident yourself, old man," he said. "You're holding him again, but you cannot get line." But soon he has to circle. The old man held him with his left hand and his shoulders now, and he stooped down and scooped up water in his right hand to get the crushed dolphin flesh off of his face. He was afraid that it might nauseate him, and he would vomit and lose his strength. When his face was cleaned, he washed his right hand in the water over the side, and then let it stay in the salt water while he watched the first light come before the sunrise. He's headed almost east, he thought. That means he is tired and going with the current. Soon he will have to circle. Then our true work begins. After he judged that his right hand had been in the water long enough, he took it out and looked at it. "It's not bad," he said, "and pain does not matter to a man." He took hold of the line carefully so that it did not fit into any of the fresh line cuts, and shifted his weight so that he could put his left hand into the sea on the other side of the skiff. "You did not do so badly for something worthless," he said to his left hand. "But there was a moment when I could not find you." Why was I not born with two good hands, he thought. Perhaps it was my fault in not training that one properly. But God knows he has had enough chances to learn. He did not do so badly in the night, though. And he has only cramped once. If he cramps again, let the line cut him off. When he thought that, he knew that he was not being clear-headed, and he thought he should choose some more of the dolphin. "But I can't," he told himself. "It is better to be light-headed than to lose your strength from nausea, and I know I cannot keep it if I eat it, since my face was in it. I will keep it for an emergency until it goes bad. But it is too late to try for strength now through nourishment." "Oh, you're stupid," he told himself. "Eat the other flying fish." It was there, cleaned and ready, and he picked it up with his left hand and ate it, chewing bones carefully and eating all of it down to the tail. "It has more nourishment than almost any fish," he thought. "At least the kind of strength that I need." "Now I have done what I can," he thought. "Let him begin to circle, and let the fight come." The sun was rising for the third time since he had put to sea when the fish started to circle. He could not see by the slant of the line that the fish was circling. It was too early for that. He just felt a faint slackening of the pressure of the line, and he commenced to pull on it gently with his right hand. It tightened, as always. But just when he reached the point where it would break, line began to come in. He slipped his shoulders and head from under the line and began to pull in line steadily and gently. He used both of his hands in a swinging motion and tried to do the pulling as much as he could with his body and his legs. His old legs and shoulders pivoted with the swinging of the pulling. "It's a very big circle," he said. "But he is circling." Then the line would not come in anymore, and he held it until he saw the drops jumping from it in the sun. Then it started out, and the old man knelt down and let it go grudgingly back into the dark water. "He's making the far part of his circle now," he said. "I must hold all I can," he thought. "The strain will shorten his circle each time. Perhaps in an hour I will see him. Now I must convince him, and then I must kill him." But the fish kept on circling slowly, and the old man was wet with sweat and tired deep into his bones 2 hours later. But the circles were much shorter now, and from the way the line slanted he could tell the fish had risen steadily while he swam. For an hour the old man had been seeing black spots before his eyes, and the sweat salted his eyes and salted the cut over his eye and on his forehead. He was not afraid of the black spots. They were normal at the tension that he was pulling on the line. Twice, though, he had felt faint and dizzy, and that had worried him. "I could not fail myself and die on a fish like this," he said. "Now that I have him coming so beautifully, God help me endure. I'll say 100 Our Fathers and 100 Hail Marys, but I cannot say them now." "Consider them said," he thought. "I'll say them later." Just then he felt a sudden banging and jerking on the line he held with his two hands. It was sharp and hard feeling and heavy. "He is hitting the wire leader with his spear," he thought. That was bound to come. He had to do that. "It may make him jump, though, and I would rather he stayed circling now. The jumps were necessary for him to take air. But after that, each one can widen the opening of the hook wound, and he can throw the hook." "Don't jump, fish," he said. "Don't jump." The fish hit the wire several more times, and each time he shook his head, the old man gave up a little line. "I must hold his pain where it is," he thought. "Mine does not matter. I can control mine, but his pain could drive him mad."